Hi, everybody. My name is David Bray. I'm an alcoholic. And my sobriety date is January 2nd, 1981. And for that period of time, I am extremely grateful. And I do want to thank PJ and your committee, Dennis, for inviting me and really bestowing upon me a privilege that today I take with a great honor. The things that I have heard behind podiums of Alcoholics Anonymous as a new member of AA, an AA member who was in a position of time where things weren't going well, sitting out in an AA group or wherever you might hear an AA talk, and you just hear things that take place in meetings like this, and they either A, comfort you, or disturb you. And generally, what will end up happening is I either have to make a decision one more time, do I or do I not suffer from an illness that is deadly? I have to remind myself on a constant basis that I'm an alcoholic. That being an alcoholic, that I suffer from an illness that kills the people that have it, and that's its only aim. And unfortunately, for most alcoholics, they will never see what you have experienced tonight. Most alcoholics will never set foot in a celebration like the one that you're holding tonight. They just die out there. They never get a chance at eating the food that was so greatly prepared. If you had something to do with preparing the food, thank you, that was wonderful. I'll tell you one thing you've known when you find out when you come to AA, if anything else, you eat well. And before you have resentment, you're full before you leave. I mean, if you're leaving, you might as well leave on a full stomach. So, but the idea that something can happen in an AA meeting, I didn't know that when I was new because all I was thinking about was me. When am I going to get mine? You know, I came here already pissed off, afraid. I didn't know it. I wouldn't have told you I was afraid. If you would have asked me, I would have said I'm not afraid of anything. And yet I was dying inside a little piece at a time. And so again, the things that have occurred in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous just like this have literally taken me from that place of despair and loneliness and terror that is the illness of alcoholism. And I've been placed in a position where our book describes, you know, we recognize we're living under this grace of a God that when I got here I didn't know existed for a guy like me. So again, I thank you for the privilege of being asked to participate in your second year anniversary. You know, being an AA group is not easy. And, you know, there's a lot of commitment that takes place in an AA group. The group that I belong to in Tulsa, Oklahoma is a group called the Going to Any Lengths Group. We just celebrated our eighth year last August. And we know the pains of being two. We don't want to be two anymore. You can have that privilege. We're grateful to be eight. We're shooting for nine, and we'll try to do that day at a time. But I'll tell you, the one thing that I do, I appreciate history. I appreciate your history of your group. I'll tell you, it's important that I remember from whence I came. And in our society, our fifth tradition of our society says that each group has a primary purpose to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. I think probably the most missed word of that tradition is its. I got to know what my group's message is before I can carry it. And so our group took the time to have its message. We sat and we decided, what do we want our group to stand on? What do we want our group to be? What do we want our group to be able to communicate? And we came up with that. It sounds like just like you've come up with a message. And we carry that to the alcoholic who still suffers. And what an amazing thing to be part of those people that get a 30-day chip and a 60-day chip and a 9-month chip, and maybe you saw them take their first desire chip, and a year later they stand up before you and they have a year of sobriety, and maybe some family members are there, and maybe a mom or a dad or a son or a daughter's got a tear in their eye because their family member is sober and they never thought they'd see that again. Now, why wouldn't I want to hold that with a higher degree of commitment and honor than the way that I used to live? So I really appreciate the fact that you've allowed me to be here tonight. I'm going to tell you who and what I am. Now, it's probably not going to come to a shock who and what I am. I'm a drunk. And I never set out to be that. My family, I've got a, my father was a professional baseball player. He was in the Chicago Cubs minor league system. I grew up in Chicago, and he blew his arm out before he made it. But we were, our whole upbringing, I got two older brothers, and our whole upbringing was sports. It's all I know, sports. My father was a fundamentalist. He did not agree with the adage, it's not how you play the game. It's not whether you win or lose. It's how you play the game. He did not believe that. If we had a motto in our house, it was, show me a loser, or show me a good loser, and I'll show you a loser. Win! And by God, we're going to know how to do it. I remember one time I was in Little League. You're like nine. I'm like 9 years old. I don't know fundamentals. I'm not Roger Clemens. I'm nine. All right? And one of the things that he reminded us all the time is when the inning is over, run off the field. Because if you watch the respectful Major League Baseball players, when an inning is over, they run off the field. Well, I forgot. I might have struck out the side. I was waving to the crowd, tipping the hat, When I got home for the next hour and a half, I ran around my house. I'm nine, running around the house. I never forgot to run off the field. And I'm not telling you that, I think, I don't know if today that'd be called child abuse. I don't know. But I'm just telling you, we were drilled fundamentalists. I know how to throw a fastball. I know how to throw a curveball. We were taught how to throw a football. I know how to shoot a basketball. I'm not good when you elevate me, so I don't do, we're in Chicago, but I don't do winter sports well. If you put me up 3 or 4 inches off the ground like on blades, that's a bad deal. I can get going. I don't know how to turn or stop, so you have to have an intervention for that, and it's usually a wall. Went out for my freshman year in high school, went out for the football team, because that's what Braves do. You go out for football. And I found out I had a medical condition that prevented me from doing really any good in football. I found out I was a coward. Man, the coach doesn't look kindly on it when the guy who's running and you're supposed to tackle him, you step aside and, hey, go ahead. It doesn't go over real big. They put people on when you play like that. In Chicago, big high schools, we had the freshman teams. There were four freshman teams, A, B, C, and D, and they fielded full teams. Now, I was on the – we had enough players where you could field a team plus have extras on each level. I rode the bench on C. I wasn't quite a derelict down to D, but, man, I was bad. I rode the bench on C, it was like the last day of football practice, and the coach came up to me, and he goes, Bray, for a guy like you who comes to football practice every day, you're without a doubt the worst football player I've ever seen in my life. And he was right. Man, I stunk. I went out for the baseball team. Now, the unfortunate thing, and right away I know I'm different. I've got an older brother, pretty good athlete. The middle brother was the best athlete of the bunch. He lettered in high school. He lettered in baseball, football, and basketball. Right away I know I'm different because I'm fat. I don't run very fast, gravity challenged. Things just don't go well. I'm a great athlete inside my head. I know what I should be doing. I've got mental graphic pictures on how it should go, but I'm stuck in a body that's just seemingly unwilling to cooperate. And I just stink at a lot of this stuff. So I go out for the baseball team. I've got on record some of the longest singles in Chicago. It's a long way for home plate to first base for a fat guy. So I don't make the baseball team, which was a crushing blow to my pride. So now this makes sense. I go out for the tennis team. Need to be kind of fleet of foot with tennis. I did well as long as they didn't return the serve. So I didn't make the tennis team, and then I found it. I found the sport. I went out for the game. I went out for the golf team, and became fairly good fairly quickly. What I found out about golf, and it was a perfect sport for a guy like me, because after you hit it, you don't have to run. You just hit it and you walk. You can walk slow. You can, what I found pretty much right after that was, once you get away from the clubhouse where the coaches sit and drink beer after you're gone, is after you hit it, you can walk, light up a cigarette and walk. Then you start lighting up various other things, and then, golf's just it's a great sport. By the time I was 16, I was competing at a high level, and by the time I was 18, I was a one handicap, and things were going well. I thought I'd arrived. My freshman year in college, I won a college golf tournament, and I won it in the first playoff hole, and I can clearly recall with vivid memory of that day. I can recall the first playoff hole. I can recall to this minute the drive I hit. I can recall the shot I hit to the green. I can recall the putt winding down the hill and going in. And I can also recall the next thought. It's time to get drunk. And that's an amazing thing for a guy like me, because, I never one time, my father and my mother taught me to have some values. They taught me to have some morals. They tried to teach me right from wrong. And I know to this day that they did as good as they could do. I knew right from wrong. But I don't know why, when I ignited the illness alcoholism, that those things were in battle. Because when I'm an alcoholic, little by little it starts stripping away my resistance to do right from wrong. And sooner or later, if you're an alcoholic like me, right from wrong is no longer even considered. What the book tells me, and the doctor's opinion, is I'm not suffering from something, some craving that I'm trying to escape, that I'm fleeing reality. What that doctor's opinion tells me is that I'm suffering from a craving that is beyond my control. That when I start having the obsession to drink, I am without defense. And I'll tell you something, for the Al-Anon members that are still here, I'll tell you something that's amazing to me, that I've watched what the insanity is. I'll tell you the most amazing insanity is that you tried to get between the alcoholic and the drink. That's silly. I learned that out on freshman football. Man, just step aside. If somebody wants something that bad, just let them have it. I mean, it's just... But see, I didn't realize that that's what I was doing. I had to start lying to drink. I had to start stealing to drink. I had to start cheating to drink. I had to start committing acts of violence to drink. I had to start doing all the things that I had to do to drink. And I didn't know that there was anything wrong. I thought that's what we do. Doctors continues to say that it's hard for the alcoholic, once this condition is cemented, it's hard for me to differentiate the true from the false. That my alcoholic life seems the only normal one. I think I'm living life normally, and people that don't understand the illness alcoholism are looking at me like, what is wrong with you? The book starts saying, geez, if you had willpower, you'd stop. She's such a sweet gal. I love that one. She's such a sweet gal. You'd think you'd stop for her. Ha! Get another one. She's so... got a drink. So what I start seeing is I have an opportunity to excel in a sport, because I'm 18 years old and I'm playing at a high competitive level, but I'm an alcoholic. And little by little, you have to practice continuously and put long hours in that game. And when you're drinking, long hours are not an option. There were times on the golf course I was so drunk, you just don't compete at a high level when you're drunk. I remember one particular tournament. I was so hungover and so nauseated that on three separate occasions I had to hit the ball purposely into the woods so I could go in and vomit, hit it back out, and continue. That's kind of a funny sensation. Your foursome members are coming into the woods with you. Do you find it yet? Yeah, I got it. Yeah, it's okay. Thank you. My freshman team, we won the Illinois Junior College State Championship. So they flew us to Odessa, Texas. Chicago is like concrete skyscrapers. You know, there's some trees there, but man, you fly into West Texas, there's like nothing. I mean, a small jackrabbit is high. I mean, my God. The first 2 days, so it's real important right now that I'm competing at this high level. And when you play in a golf tournament in college golf, your team has two. As an individual, you have an opportunity two ways. Your team makes the cut, or you as an individual can make the cut. And so myself and one of my other members of my team, we did fairly well the first 2 days of the golf tournament, and I didn't drink. Now the scouts are there. There's opportunity to be scholarships. There's opportunities right at this very minute in my time. And so the first two rounds, myself and another one of my team members do well. But our other three members of our team didn't. So those three didn't make the cut. Myself and another guy made the cut. That night I went and got drunk. I didn't mean to. The guys that didn't make the cut said, well, I'm going to go have a beer. That's all they said. Yeah, go have a beer. 4 o'clock in the morning later. Now, tee time's generally on a golf tournament about 7. So I didn't play very well the third day. So what the heck? What's the use? So I got drunk. I mean, drunk. 7:30 in the morning's my tee time, and at about 6:50 I left the bar. Now that should have meant something to me to try to participate in that golf tournament, but I just thought I'd have a drink. See, I understand the phenomenon of craving. I understand that that when I begin to drink, I lose all control. Our book describes an alcoholic of a certain kind, a type of alcoholic. And it says this type of alcoholic, the doctor described, Dr. Silkworth described as hopeless. Now, I didn't know that that's where I was. I didn't know that that's what I was becoming. I didn't know that I'm an alcoholic of this type. I thought everybody does this. Get over it. I'll get it back. Bill writes in his story, the old fierce determination came back. Well, I'll get it back. But he also writes that over any considerable time, it gets worse, never better. Gradually, things get worse. Sooner or later, I don't have the mental energy, nor do I have the desire, the discipline. I don't have anything to practice. So I said, screw it. To heck with it. Who cares? I'll get a job. So I continue to drink. Lose all that. Somehow I graduate this junior college and I go to Northern Illinois University, which is it's up in the town called DeKalb. It's about 45 miles north of Chicago, and it's really just in a cornfield. What I know about Illinois is without Chicago, it's really Iowa. It's just all corn, you know. I mean, it's just corn. And so the Northern Illinois University is basically a cornfield where they cut out little small patches and put a bunch of buildings for the university. And whatever little patches they had left, they put bars up. And so I go enroll in some classes, and I don't think I saw but about 1/5 of the classes I should have attended. And I went to the bar, and I found myself like I was looking. I mean, I don't know. Tell you a couple of quick stories. On a college campus, there's one. We just had it, Halloween. It's a great event on a college campus. I mean, a lot of good stuff happens on Halloween on a college campus. A lot of drunken things happen on college campuses. And 1980, the movie The Warriors came out, a movie about gangs. And they had a bunch of gangs fighting. And one of the gangs in this movie was called the Baseball Furies. And these Baseball Furies carried baseball bats and had baseball uniforms and beat the crap out of the other gang members. So being a mild-mannered drunk, we decided to go as the Baseball Furies. So we put uniforms on and painted our face and grabbed baseball bats. I don't have a baseball bat, so I have a – back in their days, all the closet poles were oak. So I grabbed my 4-foot oak closet pole and went to the party. Now, by this time in my drinking, there's really about one of three things that are going to take place when I start to drink. I'm an alcoholic. I don't know it yet. If somebody would have said, "You an alcoholic?" Lie detector test. No, I would have passed. I didn't know what I was. You couldn't have told me I was an alcoholic. I knew I was having problems, but alcoholics live under bridges in Chicago. I know. I throw rocks at them. I don't know I'm an alcoholic. There's no medical test to prove alcoholism. You can take my blood. It'll have the same alcohol content of somebody who drank the same amount of alcohol. They could be a non-alcoholic and just had a bender. Take blood, you're not going to prove that I'm an alcoholic. Do some EKG on the brain. Take my EKG, just kind of be flatline, I'm sure. Not a lot of going on upstairs. But you can't take a test and tell me I'm an alcoholic. But if you would have said, "Dave, when you start drinking, do you have the ability to control your drinking?" I would have been easily able to say no. By this time, when I drink, one of three outcomes. And the first is the worst. I run out before I'm done. God, I hate that. I don't know of a worser feeling than to not be done. In our book, I love how Bill uses language. Spree. The well-known stages of a spree. That kind of sounds flowery. I'm going out on a spree. Where are you going, honey? Going on a spree. You run out before you finish your spree. You're one pissed drunk, I'll tell you that. Baby, my spree got interrupted. I think I'm going to beat the crap out of you. Or I black out. Or I pass out. Those are the three options I have. That's what happens to me when I drink at this point. So I'm going to this party with my baseball uniform and my painted face and my oak closet pole. Guy hands me a beer and I drink it. The thing that was told to me the next morning, because this is one of those nights where I black out. At about 3 o'clock in the morning, somebody sees me walking across DeKalb. That doesn't seem to be in the direction back to my residence. And so they grab me and they bring me home. And the story that was told to me the following morning was I came into the apartment and I had about this much left of my oak closet pole. And I said, "Ooh, I was hurting people. And I don't remember any of it. Now, I know that I'm prone, because when you do the wrong thing, you say the wrong thing, I'm apt to throw a punch. I got a big mouth. I lose a lot, but it doesn't stop me. So that scares me. It got my attention for a minute. So I start looking for facts of the crime. Get the newspapers, DeKalb newspaper. I don't even know what it's called anymore. The school, every college campus has a school paper, lists all the crimes. So I'm looking through it to see if they've got any information listed about some goober that was painted red and white with a baseball uniform and a closet pole beating on people. And I don't find anything. So I do with that information what I've done with every other bad decision, bad action, bad thought that I've ever done with all my drinking. I just cast it aside and say, they deserve what they got, and go about my business. Late November, we have an apartment. I don't know if you can, the book says we don't like to pronounce anybody alcoholic. It's not that we don't do it, we just don't like to. I'm pronouncing three of my roommates. They're close. If they ain't, they're close. And we've got an alcoholic apartment. We have an apartment where it's four guys who like to drink. So let your imagination run with that. In the kitchen, that's a nice place. The kitchen, there is every plate, glass, cup, piece of silverware, anything that should be in a cabinet or drawer isn't. It's on the countertop, and it could be covered with any length old food. Some of them are sitting in the sink with that submerged gooey water. Paper products in our apartment, there are three, and every one of them could be used as any other one of them. Paper towel, coffee filters, toilet paper. And if you're out of one, you just go to the alternate plan. And if you're out of all three, you run to the nearest school building. I mean, that's all you know how to do. The carpet in our apartment has kind of that, I don't know, it's kind of, because a lot of stuff's been spilled in this carpet. You know, beer, bong water, piss, vomit, a lot of stuff going on. It's got kind of that alcoholic crunch to it. Late November, I come to in the living room, and my face is in the carpet. And I have an intuitive thought. I'm a junior in college, and I'm trying to major in business. And the intuitive thought was, I don't know the last time I was in class, but today I have an art test. I guess I took art. So I jump up and I look out the window and the sun's shining. So I put on my uniform of the day, which was at that point was my T-shirt that I'd cut the sleeves off of. Because by this time I'm not only drinking, I'm doing a lot of amphetamine. So I'm down to about 160. I haven't seen 160 since that day. T-shirt with the sleeves cut off of it. And it proudly proclaims on my chest, "Free me." And on the back, it's got a big fist. It's kind of like if you know how pirate ships, they fly their flag. If I could have flown a flag those days, it would have been. Put on my shorts, put on my thongs, and grab my number two pencil because I got a test. And I walk to class. And I get to the class, and it's one of those auditorium styles because it's actually a freshman art class. So it's one of that's been the big auditorium with all the other goofy freshmen. And as I'm walking up the aisle, well, I had to look up to get a seat. And as I looked up, I saw all of you, and there was something very distinguishedly different with all of you. Every single one of you is compared to me. Every one of you are in heavy winter clothing. I mean, we're not talking the windbreaker and the light stuff. We're talking the heavy stuff. We're talking the big winter coats. We're talking gloves that stick out to about here. We're talking the masks, the hats, the ski that only the eyes show. And as I'm walking up the seats, I hear somebody whisper, "What does that guy know that we don't?" Now, that's pretty much the condition I came to you in. See, because that morning when I came to, and I looked out the window and saw the sun shining, really, the synapses are not firing right now on all cylinders. And I, really, the only thought that came to my mind is sun, warm, free me. So I go home for Christmas break, looking forward to seeing family. See, by this time, I have stolen everything I can steal from my father. I've lied to him as much as I could lie to him. I've damaged his property and his possessions. I have those looks that they give you. I don't know if you've ever been on the receiving end of a look. Not a good thing to be on the receiving. They look at you like, "What are you doing? Why'd you do that?" It gets worse after that. "You really disgust us." My mother one time said, "Please don't tell us, don't tell anybody you're a part of our family." On the between the Christmas break and the holiday break, or the Christmas break and the New Year's break, my father got invited to one of his business get-togethers, and so the house is empty. So I have a bright idea, call up one or two of the close friends. It's one of those times where invite one or two and 97 show up. So another time where my parents' home, it's not my home, my parents' home and their possessions and their belongings and their livelihood is one more time destroyed, because this is a night when I drink, I pass out. So I fall in a heap on the floor in a corner of my parents' home, and now my parents' home is left ravaged by this band of thugs and thieves, my friends, my close buddies. My parents in their upstairs bedroom had the family lockbox that had the wills and the deeds and all the important stuff. And about 3 days later, after this little get-together, my mom found that in the basement, jammed behind the furnace, beaten to an inch of its life. They couldn't get in. They tried. The amazing thing is the people that I'm hanging out with, they're smart people. Lockbox wasn't locked. These are bright cats. These are bright cats that I hang out with. The only thing that kept them from their treasure was like a little lunchbox latch. So I guess they couldn't figure that out, so they just beat the box up and tried to stash it somewhere. The following morning, I hope I never forget this moment. I hope I never forget the look that my father gave me. I hope I never forget what it looks like for a father to hate his son. He looked me in the eye and he said, "You know, Dave, with a son like you, I don't need any enemies." Now, I wish I could stand here and tell you that alcoholism took me there, that I have some guilt-free ride from that day to that day. But see, I took me there. My book tells me my problem isn't alcohol. My problem is I'm selfish and I'm self-centered and I'm self-seeking, that I'm driven by 100 forms of fear, self-pity, and self-delusion. And my sponsor adds in a sixth, self-serving. It's my six-pack of self, and I carry it with me to this day. I am a selfish little turd. And my father looked at me on that day and he told me that he couldn't stand the sight of me. And now what do you do? I look out there and I love my sponsor says this, and I know what it feels like because I'm standing in that very place. He said there was a day in his life he stood out on a street corner and he said there was no friendly direction. And I know what that feels like. Because I don't know how I got to where I was standing that day, and I don't know where to go. And the book talks about, I've heard from podiums like this one, speaker after AA speaker after AA speaker who has found the magic in AA, they talk about they had this moment of clarity. Today I don't believe that moment of clarity is that I just found out I was an alcoholic. Or I have some problems. What I found out on that day, the second day of January of 1981, was that, and this is the words that came out of my mouth, if I'm going to stop drinking, I'm going to need help. I don't know where that came from, because I was taught as a young kid all the way to that very day, you never admit weakness. You don't ever let anybody know what you're feeling or you're afraid. And that day I gave in, I surrendered, I gave up, I was whooped. I don't know how it works, but they just whoosh you off. You go someplace. They whooshed me off to a treatment center. Treatment has not one single thing to do with my recovery. They make you swim in a pool you don't want to swim in. Some of them make you make wallets. Sit in front of some goober in a green suit telling you how wonderful things are going to be. And you're so damn angry you want to kill. And after 28 days, they issue your $10,000 big book. So from there, they don't know what to do with you, so they whoosh you to another place. They sent me to a halfway house. I've never determined where it's halfway from or to. The concept of a halfway house is really intriguing to me. 15 brand new, stupid, alcoholic men in one place. That's really quite... God, that's idiotic. You know how many crimes have been thought of and committed in upstairs rooms of halfway houses? We're all thieves, and they got to believe, oh, they're up there having a prayer meeting. Something very important happened to me there, though. When you're brand new, you usually end up making friends with other new people because you don't really hang out with anybody else. And I befriended a guy, and we became fast friends, and we sat at the back of AA rooms and made fun of AA members that were getting it. That made a lot of sense. And so we became good friends, and about 3 months sober, he gets drunk. And this just seemed to be the last straw, because I thought we were getting it. And my mind told me that AA, you people have been lying to me. AA don't work. My buddy's drunk. I go to save him. Figure I save him. So I walk into his apartment. He's drunk. Got a bottle of whiskey and a bunch of beer cans at the base of his recliner. I said, hey, you want to go to an AA meeting? He goes, no, you want a beer? Not happy about my sobriety. That don't look appealing, though. I got to go back to that AA. Yeah. That don't look too appealing. I don't know what to do. But in my mind, AA don't work. So I went to an AA meeting that night to resign. I didn't know that you just stopped showing up. So I go there to quit AA, and you know when somebody that's fairly new comes in and they got an attitude, you see that scowl, you know, the scrunched face. I love the scrunched face of a new alcoholic. I love that. See, it doesn't bother me. I go up to him and, how you doing, Scrunchy? What's up? I sat in that meeting with my scrunched face, preparing my exit speech. And it was obviously the guy that was leading the meeting knew it. And he tried to avoid calling on me, but he ran out of time and he had to call on me. And for about the next 3 or 4 minutes in that meeting, I said things in an AA meeting that should have never been allowed to have been said. I used the most vulgar language. I told all of you what a bunch of mindless sheep you were. I told you AA don't work. My buddy's drunk. You've lied to me. This is a fraud. You're all a bunch of, and I had every other word was profanity. And by the way, I want my money back. like I'd been putting any money in the hat. Finally, the guy that was leading the meeting said, Dave, shut up. We're tired of listening to you. He said, I want you to understand. He goes, Dave, this may be the last thing you ever hear in an AA meeting. So I want you to pay attention to it. Because we may never see you again. And you need to know the truth. He said, you know, Dave, the reason that your buddy's drunk tonight isn't because AA don't work. He said, the reason that your buddy's drunk tonight is that he chose not to work the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. But he said, that's the second point I want you to know. The first one's the most important. He said, Dave, I hope that you hear what I'm about to tell you. He said, I want you to look at every single person sitting in this room tonight. I want you to look at every single AA member around this table. He said, I want you to realize, Dave, that there's two types of people sitting in this room tonight. Two types. Two types of AA members. There's good examples of Alcoholics Anonymous, and there's bad examples of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now pick the one you want to be and shut the hell up. Well, I had my first resentment in AA. How dare him talk to me like that? And in my quest, what I have found out is that statement is the truest statement I've ever heard. There's as much bad information in AA as there is good. And unfortunately, the bad information kills new alcoholics, and it hurts a lot of old alcoholics. There's actions that take place in AA clubhouses and AA rooms that are bad examples of AA. Now, I had to be taught that. I didn't know it. I thought AA was a place where we just do whatever we want. We just don't drink. If we just don't drink, then everything is okay. And that's the biggest horse crock there is. AA isn't a convenience store. We don't do things. AA isn't about if it's convenient to you or not, if you like it or not, if it makes you feel good or not. This is about saving the lives of a dying alcoholic. Now, we've heard a lot of laughter here tonight. We've heard a lot of fellowship. We've heard a lot of the love that comes from recovery. But it comes after working the steps and not before. And if somebody tells you different, they're lying to you. It says we have a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, not as the result of eating, not as the result of having a dance, not as the result of getting up out of meetings whenever you want. My sponsor started teaching me what it meant to be an AA member. Sit down. Well, I need coffee. Get it before the meeting starts and don't get another cup until it ends. Well, God. How strict. He asked me, what are you here for? I'm here for the AA meeting. Doesn't look like it. Looks like you're here to smoke and drink. That's all you're doing, getting up, smoking, getting down, getting up. You know what? Somebody might be trying to listen that's sitting next to you, and they can't because you keep getting up and down. Sit down and stay down. God, I chose the wrong guy to be my sponsor. Message has no depth nor weight. What I have found out is this is life and death for me. I have found out that by reading that book, Alcoholics Anonymous, by taking our steps 1 through 12 in order, and by the directions of our book. You know that the sentence in our book is, and further on, clear-cut directions are given? Directions. My sponsor said, I don't give suggestions. I give direction. If you want me to be your sponsor, you're going to follow direction. If you don't want me to be a sponsor, fine. Go die. But see, my sponsor was an alcoholic of that hopeless variety. He understood what was in my eyes. He could look in my eyes and tell that I was as afraid as I could be, and I couldn't say it to him. I needed help, and I didn't know how to ask. I needed help and was afraid to tell you. There were things inside me that were so disgusting to me that I feared that if I told them to you, you'd ask me to leave. Because I was afraid that if you really found out who I was, you would not allow a person like me to sit in your good place. See, I read your steps. I read that fourth and fifth step. I knew I was going to have to tell somebody the truth. Do you know our book uses excellent words? One of my favorites that I've recently come across in our How It Works that's read, there's a word in there that says demands. It's a way of life which demands rigorous honesty. Demands. I looked up that word because when I got here, my language wasn't very good. Majority of my language was four-letter words and colorful phrases that began with mother. So I needed a dictionary that didn't have that stuff in it. So I looked the word up, demand. The definition that I like is, it is a request that has no option for refusal. Wow, that's a bad one. But it says this is a way of life which demands rigorous honesty. I'm going to have to get honest with somebody. That inventory is my first shot at this, and it may be my last. I heard the best definition of the fourth step is this, is, you know, we're out there and we're in active alcoholism and we just commit bad things. We do bad actions. We say bad things. We do bad actions. We just keep doing it. We're liars and thieves and cheats and perverts, and it's out there. And I don't know what to do with this. I'm ashamed of who I am. I'll tell you the biggest truth about myself that I have found here is I knew what I was doing was wrong and I couldn't stop. That's the greatest definition of powerless I've ever heard. I knew what I was doing was wrong, and I did not have the power to stop. So I come home and I toss that bad action or that bad thought or that bad deed or that sexual deviancy out in the backyard and quickly shut the drape. Don't want to look at it. Didn't happen. Talk to the hand. Nope. Now I get sober. And I get through those first three, and sponsor comes over to the house and says, come on. And he opens the drapes. God. You look out there, there's all your crap out there in the backyard. Man, it's a big pile of crap. There's my life. There's my alcoholic life. It's a big pile of crap out there. He said the inventory is you go out there and you get that big pile and you start making little piles. And you get a lot of little orange flags. You start labeling your little piles. Resentment. Resentment. Sex. Sex. Fear. Now you look out, and that backyard is full of hundreds of little piles with flags sticking out of them. Fifth step is finding somebody stupid enough to go out in the backyard while you tell everybody about every little pile. But most importantly about those piles is what my part of it is, where I was a thief, where I was a liar, where I was afraid. And our book says that if I've done that, and here's the kicker, if I've been honest and thorough, if I've done those things and I've been honest and thorough, it doesn't say if I've done this to the best of my ability. I'm glad it's not there because I don't have much. It says if I've been honest and thorough, sometimes and frequently a great effect is felt. We get the sense of walking hand in hand with our Creator. And I felt that because I followed the directions. I didn't get some stupid guide some other boob came up with that didn't want to do the directions out of our book. So now I've got a little freedom. Now the work keeps going, 6-7. I've got to start now initiating, grabbing a hold of this power. We get introduced to this power through Alcoholics Anonymous that, you know, on my own, I don't have the power. I know what I'm doing is wrong. I can't stop. Sometimes if I ask God for help, I get through a day and I recognize I did more good than bad. That's a good day for a new alcoholic. I did 51 good, 49 bad, but that's a good day. Then maybe sometimes it gets a little better, a little better, a little better. Sometimes I can go to sleep and I sleep the whole night. That's a miracle for a new alcoholic. See, I'm haunted by the nightmares of my past. And a lot of them are my family. I trashed my family. So now I ask God for help and I go about a business of making amends. So I go to my father and I try to make amends during my first year. That went over well. I'm glad I had a sponsor and I didn't try to do it on my own. I did exactly what my sponsor said. I told my father what I did was wrong, and I'm going to try from this point to be a type of son he might one day enjoy having. And I told him I was sorry and I'm going to do this and this and this, and I started doing this and this and this. That mother who told me don't tell people that you're part of your family, I had specific amends to make. And I did those things. Now, along the way, I do bad action, and along the way, I still do make mistakes. But the process continues to go on and on. On my 15th year birthday party, my wife got sneaky. And I'll tell you about my wife here in a second. My wife got sneaky, and she flew my parents in. I'm 15 years sober. She flew my parents in for a party that the AA group and my wife and the guys I sponsored threw. And my parents got to see Alcoholics Anonymous at its finest. The men of my group dress up in suit coats and ties. The ladies of my home group dress up in dresses and they look presentable. And they said things about my parents' son for a little bit of time about what these people were grateful for about me. Now, I'd been taking actions for 15 years, but they don't see me go to meetings. They don't see me do the things I do. I just tell them I'm an AA member, and I don't steal anymore from them. Tell them I'm an AA member. Don't lie to them anymore. tell him a name. Remember, don't wreck my father's cars anymore, burn his house down, or have his possessions stolen, or he doesn't have to worry about his lockboxes anymore. And I looked over during this little deal, and my mom was crying. And on the Sunday after the weekend, I took my parents back to the hotel, or back to the airport, and my father pulled me to the side, out there on the in front of the where you check in the baggage, and he told me that day, he said, "You know, Dave, there was a time where I thought you had a promising golf career, but," he said, "after this weekend, it's obviously that you've been called to a higher order." And see, I've been restored. The power of this program has taken a relationship that was dead in the water. It was done. He hated me. He hated me. And I had the right to, I deserved the hate. And because of the power of Alcoholics Anonymous and because a sponsor knew how to direct me through those steps, the relationship was healed. And today, every day, on the days I talk to my father, our conversations ends with, "Dad, I love you." And he says, "Dave, I love you." Now, one of the hardest things I've ever had to watch is watching my mom start dying from the disease of alcoholism. I don't know about, you know, alcoholism is just bad. It's ugly disease. But, man, it takes women down fast. And watching my mom suffer from the illness alcoholism was more than almost I could take. And I would talk to my sponsor, and I'd just tell him, "I just can't stand looking at it." She had cirrhosis of the liver, and just she was losing weight, and just it was almost impossible to watch. And he said, "You got to go, and you got to be your mom's son, and you just go there." And he would tell me about a story about his father. My sponsor's father got sober when he was 78. And he stayed sober for almost 10 years before he died, and he died a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. So he said, "Dave, we don't know what God's got in store, so we're just going to keep praying, and you keep doing what you're supposed to." So through a series of circumstances one night, my father had lost his job, so he was actually at home. And one night he wakes up, and my mom's not in the bed, and so he goes looking through the house, and he finds her in the kitchen chugging down a bottle of vodka. And the next morning he calls me, and he said, "Here's what's going on. What do we do?" So we talked a little bit, and about a week later he called me and he said, "We just stuck your mom in a treatment center." And that was on the 8th day of January in 1993. And on the 8th day of January in 1994, I got to stand up in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and I got to hand my mom her one-year sober medallion. And on the 8th day of January, in 1998, I got to stand up in a meeting in Sarasota, Florida, and I got to hand my mom her five-year sober medallion. And this January 8th, I got to stand up in my home group's meeting, and I got to hand my mom her 10-year sober medallion. And my father got up in that meeting, and he thanked Alcoholics Anonymous that they have given him his wife and his son back. Now, I'm known in my group. I don't know how else to say it. You know what I'm going to say. I don't take a lot of crap from people who don't respect AA. My sponsor says something that's almost one of the most amazing statements that I know today. "I cannot serve something I don't respect." So when I watch people get up and down and move around and get coffee because they're so damn selfish they can't stay in a seat, it's not that they're selfish, it's they haven't been taught. Maybe somebody needs to teach them. Stay in your seat. It's rude. Not judging. We report, you decide. But I'll tell you the things that I do know is that this program has saved my life. I was part of a group in Norman, Oklahoma. I'll tell you a quick story and get out of here. Part of a group in Norman, Oklahoma that very active, it was sponsorship directed, and we lived on this. It was an active group, and there was this, we called this street AA Row because it had a house of guy alcoholics, and I was living in that house, a gal alcoholics. They were doing that. There was my wife-to-be had her house, and she had her two boys. And at the end of this street was our AA clubhouse. And it was just up and down, up and down, up and down. It was AA activity. It was just going and doing, and we just had a ball. And our group was active. We carried meetings into prisons, and we carried meetings into detoxes, and we were active. We were searching. My house was always full with brand new people. It was a three-bedroom, and sometimes we had 8 or 9 sober guys, one bathroom. Now, we had the pecking order, and that was whoever has the most time goes first. And I was taught to that by my sponsor, and I was grateful because I had the most time in that house, and that was a good deal. But my wife was an active member of Al-Anon at that time, she wasn't my wife yet, but she came home from an Al-Anon conference, and she invited me over for dinner, and so we were in the kitchen, and she turned around, and I kissed her. I'm like 4 years sober, and she kissed me back. And that was an amazing thing for me. I hadn't had that happen to me in a while. Now, I still, even though I'm 4 years sober, I still have a propensity for the sun warm type of thinking. And so I did what my alcoholic mind did. I thought the very next logical thought, and so I just moved in. We started doing that deal. And one night we're lying in bed, and she asked me a question. It was kind of a stupid question, but... And I would suggest don't ask this question, ladies. She goes, Dave, what are you thinking? That's a bad question. I answered her. It was a bad answer. Before I could get the answer back in my mouth, it was out there. And what I told her was, you know, baby, I don't think I can marry you. 'Thanks for playing our game. We have some nice departing gifts for you on the way out. More like, get the... But the next week, we have a Saturday night meeting, and one of the things that was going on all the time... Anyway, she came. She had heard this joke, and she came up to me the next week, and her sponsor's from Texas, and I'm a Yankee, and so she came up to me, and she goes, you know, do you know what the difference between a Yankee and a bucket of crap is? The bucket. AK-47. Oh, no. So again, now I'm thinking, and that's a bad thing. I do the very best thing that I can come up with. I married her. And we got married on August 3rd, 1985, and last August we celebrated 18 years of marriage, and she's an active member of Al-Anon, and I'm an active guy of AA, and she sponsors a lot of Al-Anon gals, and I sponsor a bunch of these AA guys, and our home is full. Our home is full of Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon. Her two boys grew up in that crazy alcoholic lifestyle before she and I hooked up, and they got a little nuts, but they've had some program, and their lives are going pretty well. And we just have a AA Al-Anon lifestyle. And we know without a shadow of a doubt that God put us together. And we're part of this Canyon Conference that we do every year, and for the last 18 years of the Canyon Conference, there's a little chapel on the grounds where this conference is held, this little chapel. And every year we go into that chapel. And we get down on our knees and we do a third step prayer on our marriage. And we put our marriage in God's hands. And we say the third step prayer and we just ask God to take the bonds of selfishness away from us. And that He would allow us to do the things that He would have us. And we stand up in the middle of that little chapel and we take off our rings and we renew our wedding vows every year at the Canyon Conference. And I don't know of another person. I don't know of anybody who lives like I do. I just love my life today. And from the guy that came from people looking at him with such hatred, I didn't know something like that could happen to a person. I thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous. It's because of Alcoholics Anonymous that today I have a relationship with the God of my understanding. And for that, I'll always be grateful. Thank you for the privilege of participating.